PMA, pray for peace. Don't be a jerk. Please be kind. Do your do your part. Do something. All right. Okay.
Samantha Oliphant from Philadelphia. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra.
Niger guitarist Modour Maktour brings his band to the Colony Cafe in Woodstock on Monday, March 21st. Maktour is often compared to Prince and Eddie Van Halen for his renowned guitar playing, mostly on albums on the Sahel Sounds label. But his 2021 album, Afrique Victime, came out on the Matador label. He performs Monday, March 21st at 8 p.m. at the Colony Cafe in Woodstock. Go to the WGXC community calendar online for more information about this and many other local events.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marty Rosenbaum of Albany, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Now, from Survival comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just a weekend.
Get maximum protection from nuclear fallout for your family.
See a Survival shelter today.
This is Brian DeWan. I leave my clock radio tuned to 90.7 FM so that when it goes off in the morning, the first thing I hear is WGXC.
Really is designed finally to disguise the fact that when it's talking about another man, not like you, who wants what you want.
Ain't no escape from a system. Walk up from birth if they don't miss them. Ain't no escape from a system. Walk up from birth if they don't miss them.
You've been indoctrinated, highly educated, about injustice being dismissed. A white world surrounded by a blue border. Thriving off green and red, yeah, these crackers orders. Seen the love, the blood, and the money. Plato y plata, threaten the honeys. If you got a dawn color skin, government will teach you you're less than them.
Ain't no escape. Ain't no escape. Ain't no escape.
I'm agitated, we've been discriminated, locked in cages, marked as misfits, pushed to the fringes of society. Check me from day one like you some higher being.
Ain't no escape from a system. Walk up from birth if they don't miss them. Ain't no escape from a system. Walk up from birth if they don't miss them.
Scholars speak about finding a solution. Radical theorists preach a revolution. My shit's in these streets, try to bust the cap. Cops say whatever, tie they arms back. Know where I'm at, I say f*** it all. Half of y'all goofy, the other half withdraw. By your feelings and your thoughts, the media has gone. Distracted by their taunts while it's only kill us all.
This is Tongue in Cheek Assembly. I'm your Akram and Daryl Santana. We're here also again with Sean Leonardo and two other Assembly fellows that worked on these exercises with Amir and Daryl, Jeremiah, Romaine, Latham, Butler, here in spirit.
Peacekeepers shooting crowds? What? Acquitted murderers who killed a crowd. Peacekeepers shooting crowds? Acquitted murderers who killed a fucking child.
Every white man knows that he did not do it by himself. No lying, fact, nothing. Even not himself, like a child of his soul.
And so what I would suggest to the listener, and the conversation that you'll hear us have, is a triggering, no pun intended, of how we are so ingrained with particular messages that are accompanied by visuals. And so what we will attempt to do with the upcoming exercises is really problematize how we read our environment and therefore react within that same environment based on how we've received and internalized preconceived notions of criminality, and more importantly, who is criminal, who is perpetrator of violence. And so that brings us to this next question of how it is we've become so reliant on this system that externally imposes itself in our communities, because we're so ingrained with the need or the belief that we have no control over our own safety. And again, I just want to reiterate the ways in which we are tracing these exercises, you know, by gaining this historical foundation of, and understanding the emergence and expansion of the NYPD, we get clarity as to how they've become so prevalent in our lives. And it's in that messaging that our police forces control crime, that we then are offered a justification for our fear of who in our collective psyches are those bodies committing crime. In other words, by focusing the conversation on crime, we don't have to grapple with who we've internalized as criminal. And therefore, when focusing on crime, we also hand over our agency and power in dealing and conceiving safety. And so I ask the listeners this question: why is it so difficult to imagine alternatives to policing? I want you to try to visualize what might be your response to conflict that doesn't entail offering your own power and agency to an external force. And we're going to come back to this toward the end. But for a moment, we're going to actually move into an exercise that forces us to imagine a scenario without the presence of police and to think about what tactics we might utilize in de-escalating conflict within our own communities. And so what I'm going to do is sort of reciting narrative of a situation that maybe will sound familiar to many of us, that is happenstance, that occurs spontaneously and erupts in front of us. But I'm going to pause three different times in the narrative to ask how it is that we might imagine in our own responsibilities and accountability to the community of bringing down the temperature at these three different stages of the conflict. And so the one that I have in mind, and I should say that this exercise comes and has been developed by Brother Jeremiah Romaine, who you brought into the space, who unfortunately couldn't be here. And so the scenario goes like this. Imagine your typical New York City subway platform.
Yay.
Rush hour. And there's an individual, older, let's say around 50, somewhat disheveled, that appears to be struggling with homelessness, who is camped on in the center of the platform, and therefore somewhat blocking people's passage in and out the stairway. Okay? And you have then someone, younger male, let's say around mid-30s to upper-30s, a construction worker descending the staircase, clearly seems to be in a rush. And in that speed and commotion, is heading to the down the stairway and is evidently going to collide or at least run into this homeless person. And with that speed and with that commotion, already seems to be agitated. Now, the proximity gets closer and closer. And though the construction worker is moving quickly, he has enough time and space to try to avoid, let's say, or try to change course. But the person struggling with homelessness notes the construction worker's presence and, rather than evading the construction worker, moves toward him and asks if he might have a dollar. Now, the construction worker is clearly late or needs to move quickly, and therefore, without a second's notice, says, "Get the out of my way." Now, that is stage one. Now, it might be difficult as an observer to connote this situation as one in which we have accountability to our own community. But let's say you sense immediately, as we all do, that spidey sense, right? Like, this can go badly, and that it's not going to be contained, and then therefore there has to be something, there something needs to be done. Now, stage one, what are the ways that we might lower the temperature in this room, in this space? What are the tactics that one might use or imagine to cut off the tension at this phase?
I feel like my first reaction is almost humor. Like, the first thing that I go for is a bit of to insert yourself in the situation as neutrally and almost spectator-esque as possible. Just do something in order to get everyone's temperature a little out of the red and into the yellow, at least. You might not be in the green yet, but kind of detract from what's happening right now.
Well said. A little bit of a distraction, huh?
I think maybe further distraction, I think, like, clog. Like, how do I clog that scenario? As in, like, put myself in a way where that what the person said, the construction worker that was descending, where that's no longer the primary relationship that's happening. So, like, put myself in and actually just, like, give a dollar. Like, get in the space and give a dollar. And that the dollar isn't the matter, but it's the fact that, like, I have to put my body there.
Very nice.
And then that other person can, you know, also off.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with Tim. I would offer the dollar over, because I don't know, I feel like that could go either way. Like, if he didn't and the dude, like, told him to get the fuck away, because when he told him to get the fuck away, like, this man could either go crazy mode, because, you know, out of the 500 people that he's probably seen all day, he's probably the only one that he's interacted with. Like, being homeless, like, a lot of folks often feel overlooked, and, you know, we step over them and we just don't really look their direction or, like, give them the time of the day. So it's kind of like, you know, with that one, it's like, yeah, I would give the dude the dollar, but then at the same time, like, I don't know, I would See, talking to the other guy could go either way for me, too. Mm. Because at that point, like, he could be agitated with me because now he thinks I'm in cahoots with the other guy. This could have, like, went either way. Like, both of y'all could have been blowing up and he could have had, you know, a rusty screwdriver that you ain't never know about. Mm-hmm.
But also, thank you for naming the risk in this scenario, because the risk is going to be enhanced with each stage of this conflict, of this confrontation, as you'll see. But unfortunately, no one did anything. Or this initial strategy that you've attempted has failed. And therefore, the older man that is struggling with homelessness does get activated and responds with a level of aggression that supersedes the "get out of my way." The volume has now risen, and the response sounds something more like, let's say, "Don't talk to me that way." And now the construction worker, the younger man, has paused. And they're now only a foot away from each other. And you can see that this younger man seems to be reddening in the face. You have also noticed that he has started to clench his fists. Pause. Stage two. What's possible here?
You know you hate yourself for that first New York reaction of move to the other side of the subway. If you are seeing it and you have put yourself in the shoes of someone that's attempting to stop this from happening, maybe concern of your family, your friend, someone around nearby, I would think the best approach would be to approach the younger man first as he reaches the older man's level, telling him, "Look, man, that's not worth it. Aren't you on your way to work? Don't you have something you need to do that's a bit greater than this? Is it worth risking yourself for that?" And then confronting. Now, confrontation is a dangerous word in this situation because you are already inserting yourself. But to look at the older man and almost ask, like, "What do you need?" But that depends on how much are you going out of your way. I might be the person to be like, "I hope I have a drink. I hope I have some food in my bag." And give it to him, like, here's this. I don't have any money for you, but here's this. I'm sorry that this had to happen. Almost confront everybody and make them both feel heard and seen.
Well said, Amir.
There's like me knowing my first like New York instinct of being like, yes, I'm going to move across. I'm going to like steer my way around. Or maybe I'm like, if I'm halfway down the stairs, I might like go up and like make a phone call or something, right? So there is like certainly an instinct of avoidance. If I'm faced with the task of cooling the temperature, I think again some kind of distraction. So like, the first thing I thought was like, what would happen if I just was like, you know, like just acted more, like more ridiculous. And so I became the center of attention.
As ridiculous as it sounds, and I want to stop here for a second, because while you're all using the tactic or the word distraction as the definition of how you would approach it, you're actually naming very different strategies. And we'll come back to how distraction can actually serve different purposes depending on what you do.
Mm-hmm. In these exercises, I'm learning that the skills that you're learning can be applied all like slowly. So I feel like with time, I feel like I could understand how to navigate through a situation like this, because you're already clearly seeing like fight or flight mode already like being activated. So in fight or flight mode, most times some people's vision gets kind of tunneled, and I don't know, like sometimes anger can also be misplaced. So you also have to approach the situation with a certain type of caution, because either party could blow up dramatically. But it's the way of trying to speak these sense into them without having them feel like they're attacked or like bombarded, or like they have to feel guilty for feeling like these ways, because, you know, in reality we're all humans and we all have emotions. So I think that's one thing like people fail to realize if you're like also stuck in your own sense of perception. So with that one, you never know, like you could just walk up and both of them could be fighting you, because now, like, you know, they're thinking that either you could be with part of one of the other party, or like you're just trying to get in on some action too. Like, this one is weird. I don't have an answer.
And, you know, listen, all three of you have voiced what your immediate reaction and instinct and how that occurred to you, whether it was the flight or the calling of, or just the avoidance. And these are the natural tendencies, because at some point we're also thinking about self-preservation mm-hmm. in a moment of conflict. Mm-hmm. And I also want to echo something that you've offered, Daryl, in that, you know, in taking the inherent risk, it's not only about the tactic, but how the tactic is implemented. And so acknowledging that these two individuals are already in fight or flight or freeze mode, and knowing what that looks like in a body will actually allow you to approach the scenario with much more centeredness and calm, which is an important piece that we'll pick up on later. However, we failed again. And to raise the stakes, you now see that there are other people around that have gathered. Some pulled out their phones. And the platform is now crowding more than it was. And they start to push each other. The construction worker has responded with, "I'll kick your ass." And the older man that is struggling with homelessness responds with, "You don't know who you're dealing with." And they start shoving each other. And now that the platform has crowded, you've noticed that there are children being pushed to the edge of the platform. And you notice that whether it's your family or friends, those that are closest to you are frightened. And they are incapable in their own freeze mode to move away from the situation. Stage 3.
This is actually one I can see happening for me, which is problematic in my own personal life, and I will not get into it. But this is a time where you do a tap into other people. So you approach... either you approach the biggest people around you. That's the first thing. And you say, "We just need to hold them down right now." That's exactly it. Like, our move is to, I hate to say it, but literally tackle these men and be like, "Yo, you both got to chill." Or just hold their arms back in their legs and be like, "Y'all need to relax." And that's when the quick de-escalation or the quick talk happens, where you're just like, one, you're on your way to work. Why would you even let this get to you like that? A homeless man too. You have much more to deal with than this. You're already highly at risk. Please, you know what happens next. If the cops get involved, you're both in trouble. Just relax. But that's physical restraint and then aggressive speech. Mm. That's all I could think of at that point. Mm.
I agree with the physical restraint. I feel like in that moment in time anyways, like, the police would already be contacted, realistically. Like, if there's some people out recording, but you know, there's some people who already have their phone handy and they're seeing this happen. So mm-hmm. some people with the police mindset are ready to just run straight to the cops. Like, I'm already foreseeing that happening. So right. I'm trying to end this situation as fast as I can, because as soon as the cops come, we already know from like speaking before, like they, well, I don't think we really mentioned this, but they don't come there to fix a crime. They come there as like a reaction to a crime, like cause and effect. So yeah, somebody's fighting. Oh, we're here just for the fighting. We don't care about nothing else. Mm-hmm. We don't want to hear no sides. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to jail. So right. we've stopped it from getting any worse, because if you've noticed in the news, like last week in the Bronx, something like this basically was happening, where people were like jumping this one dude and somebody else went to go help them and jumped into the train tracks to pull them out, and they ended up getting killed mm-hmm. for it. So I guess I just want to reduce those types of factors too, where like we have the kids at the edge, so a train could easily come, and if you're all like scrambling and fighting and the kid falls off the edge and gets hit by a train, like that just a whole lot of paperwork in general. Mm-hmm. Police gonna have to file for the little kid, but then they're also gonna have to arrest both of these individuals.
And so ultimately what we're talking about here as an upstander, which is the term that I'll define in a moment, is an attunement for not only what is occurring in your body, but an awareness of how this escalation of conflict and its intensity is impacting more than just the actors. And therefore, the ways in which, in immediate tactics, you approach with the goal of not solving anything, simply lowering the intensity for the sake of everyone around. And I love this idea of calling in support.
Yeah.
Because by no means is this something that you have to enact on your own.
Can I, just in a thought, I can't even think of the step of like how to, because I wouldn't go to the step of restraint. The possibility of turning to the people that are starting to surround and just being like, hey, can you help me?
That's right.
Right? And saying, I need support. Or, you know, maybe starting with that, being like, or can I help you? Right? And they're like, what do you need to help me for? And then it's like, well, this looks blah, blah, blah. Like starting a conversation maybe with others that are differentiating themselves already from the two that are fighting.
And I can tell you from personal experience that this is actually a really effective tactic. Because once those that are in that fight and flight mode notice, even in their periphery, that there are two, at least two people that are wishing to intervene, it goes it becomes much more palpable.
It's kind of like getting the momentum moving, because you know, some people, they could really have like the thoughts of doing it, but some people don't have the commitment to make it actually happen.
That's right. But as soon as there's an additional body, that collectivity actually brings an energy into the space that can be quite helpful. And so, you know, what we're really talking about here is what it means to act as an upstander, who is someone who witnesses an incident and chooses to intervene. This is a choice. Chooses to intervene to support someone being harassed, intimidated, discriminated against, attacked, bullied, or otherwise dehumanized. Now, I chose a particular scenario in which it might be hard to look at the two aggressors and describe either of them as victim or as someone that is defenseless. And so in this scenario, we're looking at upstander as someone that has the attunement and awareness to understand this is going to go badly for everyone. But I also want to acknowledge and bring in something you said, Tim, when you said when you mentioned that I would have a hard time being the person that he would even think about restraint. That as an upstander and the skills that we might learn and enact as upstanders is really important to also be aware of your own limits. This is not about being a hero or a savior. And to acknowledge how your own subjectivity, your own body, may not be the thing, you may not be the person that could successfully enact one of these tactics. Or you might be the person to carry more responsibility in the space depending on your body, depending on how your subjectivity might be read in the room. And so I'm going to list a few and actually sort of categorize some of what you've all suggested in terms of tactics of intervention. I'm going to name some de-escalation strategies that are provided by the Center for Anti-Violence Education, and it's given the acronym of GAMBLIN, GAMBLIN.
Oh, I'm from Atlantic City. That just scars.
That's what's up.
That scars.
And so the G, and I should clarify in that many of the tactics that we'll go through could be utilized from the position of someone that is in the conflict. So if you do regain the composure and wish to, as one of the actors, lower the temperature, these are also tactics or strategies that can be used. But for our purposes, we're looking at this as an upstander, someone that is a third party, willing and able, an acknowledgement of their own body, size, appearance, subjectivity, to intervene. So the G would be to get to we. And now you might want to think about it this way. You have these two actors that are entering into this confrontation. At this point, it doesn't matter who did what. And you all started to mention this, in which you want to bring their consciousness to everyone on the platform. So you might say, do we really need this? And the we all of a sudden may snap them out of themselves and see like, oh, there are other people being impacted here. That might be really useful in, let's say, a stage one. The A, offer alternatives. And some of you started to mention this, like, I'll just give the dollar. Right. And you might even say to the construction worker, this is about a dollar. I'll just give the dollar. Or it might actually be more of a direct act. Like, why don't you come over here? Offer the alternative. M is match and lead to step down. Now, this is a difficult one. And I would suggest one that poses a real risk as the escalation goes higher and higher. But by match, it says you actually want to meet the person at the temperature that they're at and then walk them down. And so as silly as your recommendation was of the blah, 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 Tim, this might look like, whoa. And be like, come on, man. We all just trying to get to work. And then keep lowering. Like, this is about a dollar, dude. Come on. You start there and go down. But if you can imagine stepping in at number three, like, and if you're stepping in at stage three and trying to roughhouse, that's likely not going to work.
Oh, God.
Though I've seen people try to attempt that type of posturing, right? The B in gambling is broken record, which is not something anyone named specifically. But you might intervene by saying, anything really, but it's a process of being on repeat. Like, this is getting out of hand, y'all. This is getting out of hand, y'all. This is getting out of hand, y'all. L in gambling is lose to win, which is more of an effective tool if you are actually in the confrontation. But essentially, this means pick your battle. And what you might offer in this case is, is really grounding in any one of the individuals what the stakes are. It's like, is this really what you want to do? Look at how afraid this kid is right now. Do you really want to fight this person? Don't you have to get to work? I statements. And again, this is another tactic or approach where it's really like, if you're in conflict, you're naming where you're at. So rather than vilifying the person in front of you, you're saying like, I'm not feeling good about this, or I got pissed because you said this. This is, you know, an effective tool in relationship therapy. But as an upstander, I do think it's another way of creating a larger consciousness and saying something like, I'm just trying to get to work, y'all, and this is getting intense. Like, I'm just trying to be here with my family. Can you see what this is doing? So you're actually drawing the guilt away from either party and saying, like, it's actually not about this person in front of you. Can you see me right now? I'm afraid. I'm getting pissed. If this is at a stage one or stage two, and maybe you're a sizable human being, you might say, like, y'all two are pissing me off. And then you're actually engaging them and saying, like, you really want to fight? Why don't you try to fight me? I've seen this work actually really well. But maybe not the greatest attempt at stage three, or if you're someone that's on the smaller side, right? And then finally, and I find this to be crucial when it gets to stage three, name the behavior. It's a way of breaking through the aggression and getting to the vulnerability of that individual. And you might say, you're annoyed. That's okay. Or you might say to the, as you were indicating, Daryl, like, you feel insulted. You probably didn't want that interaction, did you? You're dealing with a lot, aren't you? This is pissing you off, right? And you might want to say that you're just trying to get to work. You didn't want someone to get in your way. You name it. And all of a sudden someone's like, oh, I'm being seen. I'm being heard. But what it entails is you're positioning yourself in the middle as someone that is actually a soundboard maybe for both individuals. And sometimes all it requires is drawing that person away to name the behavior and having them know, like, your actions are actually different than your feelings. But then now we've all still messed up and the fight has broken out. And now the police are on the scene. And so we want to move to a final exercise with a little bit of time. This will be a quick one. And Amir, do you feel comfortable sort of walking through the container for this?
Of course. So, as you've seen, you're still in this crowded subway station. There's these two men, a construction worker who was in a rush on his way to work, and a homeless man asking for a dollar. They're heated to the point where nothing you do, nothing you say can get to them. Swings have started. Blows are being had. Children are wide-eyed and scared. People are yelling, stop, no, don't do that. It's not worth it, but nothing's working. You see run down the stairs, two people in uniforms. Behind them, another person in a uniform. Boys in blue, they're just doing what they have to do. They're yelling, stop now.
And now we're going to invite you to do something that might be a little difficult, given the context of this conversation and where we've arrived. We want you to imagine that you're one of those officers. See that scene in your mind. Take in that entire environment and try to be as specific as possible in the visual detail. Who is on that platform? What are they wearing? What do these two individuals in conflict look like? What is being said? What does it sound like? What are they wearing? Is there a subway approaching? What is the light like? How many people are on that platform? How does the staircase feel underneath your feet? What colors are around you? Be in that place. And we're going to give you a moment. And now, we want you to focus not on anything that is around you, but we want you to be in your body. What sensations are running through you? What charge are you experiencing in your nervous system? What is it that your body is actually doing? Try to describe that movement precisely. The arch of your neck, the posture of your back. How are you holding your hands? The bend in your knees, the expression of your face. What does that feel like? And I'm going to turn to y'all. What images, and more importantly, how would you describe, what words would you use to describe the embodiment of that scene? What are you feeling? Any of you?
Short breath.
Short breath. Thank you, Tim.
So tightening, like my core, upper body, torso is like tight at the same time in stability. Like, at least when I was thinking about the stairs, I was thinking about I'm wearing these big boots. They're kind of uneven on the edge of the stair as I'm going down and trying to go down fast. Like, boots that don't look like they bend either.
Your jaw is clenched. Mm. You feel yourself slipping as you slide down the steps. You're wondering in your mind. You're not really thinking much. You're just reacting. You think about the weapon on your side, then you grab the other one. You look at the other officers, you see them scrambling, your heart is just beating out of your chest. Every muscle in your body's got to a point, even your legs are tight. You could feel your toes curling in your boots.
Visualizing being a cop in this situation, I don't know if I would have like any of the telltale signs of like nervousness. I think there would be some sort of stoic, like kind of a stoic look to me while going to this situation. Like, I don't know. I feel like if it's not gunshots, I don't think I would be nervous as a cop. Mm. Going down the stairs is kind of just like regular, I guess. Like, you know, you're just walking in there and it's just like, well, another day at work. Like, at this moment, I wouldn't say I'm calm, but I do have an authoritative, like, kind of stature to me. So when you look, like, you know something is already going down, or like you're already coming to the conclusion that somebody's getting locked up. I feel like they train you to just be like, not, you don't, like, there's no type of emotional type of thing. That's why when people try to hit them with sob stories, like, oh, this wasn't for that, like, they don't care to hear that. Like, they were only here to stop you from doing what you were already doing.
Hmm.
So in that kind of like mind frame, it's not like I'm losing anything per se. Like, in there, it's like, I don't know. I guess like it would just be like a regular day for me.
Mm. And so in the combination of these interpretations and the ways in which we've embodied the scene as, to use your word, Daryl, the position of authority, what is the expectation of what happens next?
Faces pressed to the ground, cuffs coming off, coming off the loop onto hands. Kind of that jerk when you see the physical action really being taken. I'm outside now looking in. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh damn, saw that coming. Your hands are clenched. You're just uncomfortable. You don't want to look anymore. Mm.
I'm thinking of me embodying the energy of the people around me. Mm. So in that energy, it would more so, like, I know there would be some type of, what do you call that, tension? It would still be tension, but the thing that seems to be underlined is kind of like entertainment, in mm-hmm. a sense. So you'll have some people laughing here and there. You'll have, like, some people that's genuinely shocked, or you'll just have people that's just like, oh, okay. In the situation that I'm the homeless person, that one can go either way. Like, some people just like to, like, you know, homeless people, like, some people, they would like to get arrested because that's just like a free bed for them. Like, you know, I've known a few that decided to just do weird things to just go to jail just to sleep and eat. So, but then in the term of, like, the working person, like, seeing the cops come in, it's like, all right, damn, like, perceived danger of, and it's not even, like, danger, like, well, yeah, there's a possibility that you can lose your life. So that's where both of them, like, with the homeless person and, like, the person going to work, that's what I could see, like, you know, both of them are shook because they both did get into, like, this altercation. But now, this guy's, like, pressure is a little bit more because he has things to lose. I don't know, I could have kids, I could have a wife, and this whole job, like, if I lose, like, this, like, say, like, you're on a second chance program, like, and I just came out of jail for just brutally, like, beating somebody up, and this is, like, my second chance, and here I am again fighting, and now I've lost, like, my stability because of that.
And so ultimately, we want to end with this question of, as we describe the different possibilities of how this gets out of hand, how it continues to escalate, and then what occurs with police presence and the control, I'm going to keep returning to that word, of this situation. The question then comes, is this what we want? And now, I think many of us will move immediately into the defense of, yeah, they got into the fight, they should be removed from the situation. And then we immediately forget of all the danger that posed to everyone else on that platform. Like, let's remember, this altercation is happening. And yes, while there might be some entertained, we've already described the fear in other people's bodies. We have already described the risk of children being pushed to the edges. We've already described the fear that you are inhabiting in your own body. And we've also already talked about the training, as you've called it, Daryl, of what police officers arriving to the scene are being asked to respond to, and therefore how they are trained to deal with this situation. In their minds, there's only one scenario, and therefore one reaction: contain and control. And yet in that containment, there's no assessment of the danger and risk that it poses to everyone else in that space. And certainly there is no reading of how that in and of itself might make the scenario worse. And so we have to ask ourselves, is this what we want? And I would argue, and I think what we're arguing with this series of workshops and listening, visualization, embodiment, is that it's not an accident that we default into thinking that the police are the best scenario or the best solution to this issue. There's violence, there's aggression, there are now blows, there's danger. We should want these two bodies removed. And yet, we have to ask ourselves, why is this so much easier to just think that the police presence is the right thing in this scenario if we already can, in our bodies, understand that the situation has worsened? We have to ask ourselves, why is it so hard for us to imagine collective agency and power of enacting safety in this scenario or any scenario that we might recall in our lived experience? Why has it been that we've deemed that safety is not within our own reach and that therefore we are not accountable to our own measures of community safety?
Based off of what we did today, and because you have this peer leadership position as a fellow, but, you know, something that's a longer engagement, this is a different version of maybe, or this is a similar question to what I asked Sean last time, is what role you feel like your imagination plays in a leadership role? I think that's a very big question, but I'm wondering what comes to mind, be it, you know, what we did, some of what we did today.
I love that question, actually.
Or be it a scenario that you feel like you've encountered at recess assembly.
When I think of the leadership that recess gives us, or ask of us at times, I think of being an educator and sort of a co-producer, as I'd put it, where, as you've already mentioned and picked up on, this is not hierarchical. But what we can do, or what I can do at the time, is I think I can offer you some information. I think I have things I can tell you that are going to relate to whatever project you're doing, whatever pursuit you're in. And I think that that information will help you. But then after that, I can be beside you with whatever questions you may have, with whatever struggles you may be going through. And I can give you what I would think would be solutions. And I can hold your hand at the times you need your hand held. I think being a leader at recess has really taught me the fact that being a leader isn't pointing to someone and bossing them around. It's more being willing to walk beside them, and that those times where they feel almost as if they have to crawl, you can hold them.
Does in that scenario, in being, I like that word, co-producer, like, is being a co-producer require some specific kind of imagination?
I think, if I can say anything, the kind of imagination it requires is an empathetic one.
What is that?
I think an empathetic imagination is, I need to understand where you're coming from and what you're doing. But after I do that process, then visioning, I can help, I can be a part of with you. But first comes understanding, then comes envisionment.
I want to offer one other thing that sort of, I think, really conveys the container for the assembly work, and more, even more specifically, the community safety workshops. In that abolition, which is a term that's been thrown around and which we didn't really take very much time to define, but you know, without doing that, I will just say that abolition is an act of radical imagination, and the ways in which we therefore imagine a new system or a new way of belonging, a new way of existing with one another that doesn't involve violence, that doesn't require externalizing our agency over safety. All of that is a radical act of imagination because it has been systemically stripped away from us. The act of imagining a different system is very much the role of the artist. And when we think about abolition, the removal of interlocking systems that cause harm, it is this bestowing of imagination and the act of artistry that allows us to visualize all of these steps to a world that we can't even see, that we can't even touch.
I have another question, but I'm just going to ask it, and you don't have to answer it. Okay. And it could both be in terms of both of your perception of the history of assembly, or in your, you know, mirror echo tilt, like beginnings of of how you and Sabolee Smith and
Melanie Crean,
how it emerged from that. But how do you, with it's, and also with this like pull of thinking about abolition and radical imagination and how those have start what they're generating, you know, how do you convince a juridical court system that is so based on written language, linear conceptions of time, like, you know, measurable things, how do you convince a court system to support something like this, which in a grander, in a greater sense would be called a diversion program?
That's right.
When the task of it is also towards abolition.
I'm not sure if political intimacy would play a part in this. Political intimacy is a project that's collaborative with Pratt University and Recess. And what we do is we demystify and humanize more of the electoral process for like DAs and like mayors and things like that. So when it comes to that, I think that really gave us a platform to really speak to them and see like how did this happen, or like if you were to like get elected, like what are the steps that you would take to like change this said law? Like I feel like more education on learning that you could speak to your local governments and learn that like a lot of things could be changed, but they just have to be changed around us first. And we can't rely on like the higher judicial powers of like, you know, the federal government. Like we have to worry about like what's immediately around us first. So to answer your question, that's
great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a great answer. And it, and also that even the term political intimacy can also mean like not becoming just close with local politics, but also it's like maybe a question is like, can politics be intimate?
That's right.
And what would that mean? And how would that, I just like glanced at this. What would it mean to de-escalate politics? Like if you go through this, how do you get to the we with politicians, right? Or how do you... what are the other ones? Match, lead, and step it down with a pause.
Yeah, I mean, I to your point, Tim, I think the way we operate is both a cooperation and an agitation of how we interact with and against systems. And I think what most people misunderstand about something like the assembly program or a larger, the larger philosophical notion of diversion is that in order to enact change, you have to both know a system extremely well to be able to incrementally create rupture from within and create models that exist outside of that same system. And I think the best example that you might have or receive in a response to your question is exactly what's happening right here. For these two young men to be with me, an educator and mentor that you know has spent years with them in the space, to create a completely different model of how we interact with one another, how we care for one another, how we exist in a non-hierarchical fashion and learn from one another so that we can create a space that acts separately from the realities that impose themselves on our lives.
Amir, Daryl, Sean, so great. Thank you so much.
Imagine smoking weed in the street without cops harassing. Imagine going to court with no trial. Lifestyle cruising blue behind the waters. No welfare supporters. More conscious of the way we raise our daughters. Days are shorter, nights are colder. Feeling like life is over. These snakes strike like a cobra. The world's hot, my son got knocked. Evidently, it's elementary. They want us all